them, give us a feedback, because without your feedback, we'll be able to improve what we are doing. We look forward, please genuinely get into those forms filled that Ian presented to one of our So I'll start right away, and we'll start with Dr. Don Smith. Don is a medical epidemiologist at the CDC, and she had begun her international HIV research experience in my country, Uganda, and also in South Africa, and has recently returned to Atlanta from over 4 years in Botswana, establishing a clinical trial site and getting the PrEP trials underway. She's currently responsible for providing guidance to the CDC on international and domestic PrEP trials, and has the lead in the planning and coordination for implementation of PrEP when and if it proves worthwhile. Dawn will be addressing the question, how prepared are we for PrEP?
Hello. Can I have the first slide, please?
Can we have the first slide?
Okay. As the professor said, we are really here to open a conversation. And so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what the conversations have been like at CDC about implementation, but I'm really looking forward to the comments from you here and to the ideas that you will have about implementation. The first thing I just wanted to run through was sort of where we are with the PrEP trials. The trial in Thailand in injection drug users using tenofovir expects to have its first interim analysis in the spring of next year. That was part of the impetus for having these kinds of conversations. That's not very far away, and the final analysis will be approximately a year after that. And when you think about the challenges that will be involved in implementing PrEP, having a year or two to think through those things and come to some consensus about what we would do if it proves efficacious, that's not very much time. As you can see, there are also trials underway among heterosexual men and women in Botswana, and now among MSM in Peru and Ecuador. Congratulations to Bob Grant for actually finally getting his first participants enrolled. We're very excited about that. And then there are a number of efficacy trials that are being discussed that are still in development. There's the safety trial underway in the United States, and an additional safety trial that's in development potentially for women in Thailand. So one question that came up at CDC was, why should we start planning before the trial results are in? Shouldn't we wait and see if this works before we put a lot of time and energy into that? But I think there's sort of two reasons that we decided to go ahead and start thinking about it. One is that we have reasons to be optimistic that these trials will be successful. And we know that it will take time to plan effectively. In the U.S., a new biomedical intervention for HIV/AIDS is a process that we haven't really done. We've been focusing on community engagement and behavior change strategies. And so having to think about how CDC would work with a biomedical intervention is a little bit complicated. There are lots of factors that we need to take account in planning for this, and we need to consider the viewpoints of quite a wide range of potential users and providers and policymakers. When I say that trials may prove efficacy, I think it's reasonable to think about this as a potentially efficacious intervention for a number of reasons. Number one is there's biological plausibility. We know the mechanism by which this would potentially protect against HIV transmission. We know that these drugs have concentrated levels in the genital tract, which is where the majority of the world's transmissions occur. We know that it works in animal models. We know that PrEP works for post-exposure prophylaxis. And we know that safety was demonstrated in the FHI trial that's already been completed. In addition, despite imperfect adherence with other kinds of antimicrobial pre-exposure prophylaxis, we know it works for the prevention of mother-to-child transmission, for the prevention of malaria in travelers, and for the prevention of OIs in a variety of AIDS-related infections. On the other hand, we are doing trials for a reason, and that is that it may not, in fact, prove to be efficacious. But even if that's the case, the planning that we do now will come in handy when we have to plan for the next effective biomedical intervention, whether that be microbicides or vaccines. So it's not a wasted exercise, even in that event. Now, the other thing to think about is that unlike vaccines and microbicides, the drugs being used for pre-exposure prophylaxis are already improved and available for the treatment of HIV infection around the world. So we're not talking about developing a new regulatory process or a new manufacturing and distribution process. These drugs are already available at reduced cost in many places, and generic licensing is already in place around the world, which would help greatly with the scale-up, not just for treatment, but if necessary for prevention. In the U.S., we have a special case, and that is that the way that regulation of drugs works in the United States, once a drug is licensed for a use, it can be used for other uses at the discretion of physicians. And therefore, the day that a trial announces efficacy, any physician in the United States can begin prescribing it. And so it will stand us in good stead if we have guidance in place at that time so that it becomes implemented quickly, but in an appropriate manner. The last thing before I talk about some of the issues that we're talking about is that in the early discussions at CDC, we found that we had to move from a process of identifying all the things that could possibly go wrong with PrEP implementation to more of a problem-solving framework. So instead of talking about whether PrEP would divert treatment funds, we began to talk about what existing or new funding streams will cover PrEP. Instead of talking about whether risk behavior will increase, we began talking about how would we include affordable risk reduction counseling in the package of services that would be available along with the medication. We also set up a process that would allow us to include multiple perspectives throughout the planning process, and that includes potential users and providers, but also program officials at the state and national level, policymakers, communities themselves that would be heavily involved with this kind of implementation, the media, prevention advocates, researchers, and explicitly politicians. We thought about using the framework of the Global Prevention Working Group in terms of planning for the rapid introduction to achieve what they called sufficient coverage intensity and duration to have optimal public health impact. We also wanted to build the program to take advantage of some of the features of PrEP that we can anticipate. This would be an intervention that is gender neutral, can be used by both men and women equally, but one in which covert use is feasible. Taking a pill without letting other people know that that's what you're doing would be a fairly simple process. One that's coitally independent and may, importantly, work for more than one type of exposure. Right now, if you're an injection drug user, for example, you would have one intervention for your risk associated with your injection use and a second intervention for your risk associated with your sexual activity. PrEP has the possibility of interfering with transmission by both mechanisms through one intervention. It's also an intervention that can be stopped and started. So if you're going through a period of high-risk activity, you might begin to take PrEP, and a couple years later you may be in a more stable relationship or situation and feel that you don't need it, and it would be very simple to stop taking it at that point. The most important advantage of the PrEP program that we want to be sure we build in is that this would be the first time that we would have an opportunity to get high-risk people in for periodic risk reduction counseling and HIV testing. We spend a lot of time trying to get people in for one-shot testing or for testing every year. But the opportunity to work with people every 3 months or every 6 months over a couple of years is a very important benefit of the way we would like to use PrEP. The other issue has to do with linking men as well as women to preventive care. In the United States, as in many other places, men access healthcare services much less frequently than women do. And so this would be one way to begin doing some prevention work with men. So for an example, in the U.S., when we thought about how do we provide PrEP to high-incidence populations, we thought about who is it who can provide each component. This is a biomedical intervention, but physicians, for example, may not have the time and the structure to provide adequate counseling. On the other hand, the CBOs in the community may have the counseling expertise but won't be providing medication. Is there a way we can build the program to take advantage of those sets of experience? Where will people, where can we put the program so that people have acceptable access? We tend to put biomedical interventions first in major medical centers, and yet we know that many of the populations in the U.S. that are most in need of this kind of intervention don't have access to those services. So are there alternative delivery sites that we can think of? Who are the messengers who will talk to the people about this intervention and bring them to care? Another issue in the U.S. where we don't have government-sponsored health care for all citizens is how do we reimburse for this package? We do have a system of reduced cost pricing for medications, which includes antiretrovirals. But that reduced cost pricing is only available in a defined set of clinics and institutions. How do we make sure that those are included in the early implementation of PrEP? So again, this is just an example. For each part of the planning process, there develops a whole series of questions that require people with different expertise and background to work through and come up with appropriate alternatives. The other thing we want to be sure is that throughout this process we have systematic evaluation. And that starts with the trials data. So we'll learn quite a lot from the trials, not just about efficacy, but for example, what's the frequency of safety monitoring that's needed and how would that be built into a program? We need to look at the existing data on our high-incidence populations to know where we need to focus this implementation. And we need to do data collection specifically around missing pieces of information that we need for implementation planning. Then we will probably want to engage in some demonstration or pilot projects. And throughout this process, we want to establish in advance what the evaluation criteria and mechanisms will be so that as we're rolling this out, we get information on the costs for various kinds of services, the process outcomes, the intermediate outcomes, and most importantly, the impact that it's having on HIV incidence. So given all that, CDC has initiated conversations with a wide variety of stakeholders. First of all, to raise awareness about pre-exposure prophylaxis and the fact that we're only months to a year or two away from definitive data and decisions about implementation. We've assembled a multidisciplinary study group within CDC that includes people from the STD program, the reproductive health program, the HIV domestic program, the global program, to start working on implementation planning and the evaluation questions. We've put in place a process to do some surveys of national stakeholders, program managers, and potential participants so that we understand their perspectives on what it would take to implement PrEP effectively. And we're planning some focus groups with potential users about desired characteristics of a program, where they would prefer to access this kind of service, for example. In addition, the trial the U.S. Trial Community Advisory Boards have formed a joint committee to discuss community perspectives on possible implementation. One specific problem that we have in the U.S. is that we have a very high level of racial and ethnic disparities that affect our epidemic. And it's very important that we not allow PrEP to be implemented in a way that aggravates or fails to deal with those disparities. So, for example, the rate of HIV diagnosis in black adults and adolescents in the U.S. is 10 times the rate for whites. African Americans are 13% of the U.S. population, but they represent more than half the people diagnosed with HIV and AIDS. 61% of those under the age of 25 at HIV/AIDS diagnosis were black in 2005. And in black, especially in young black MSM, we have very high incidence rates, rates that you would see in KwaZulu-Natal, for example, where in a seven-city study, the incidence in this population was 14.7% per year, whereas in the white young men, it was 2.5%. We also know that in the treatment arena, blacks are less likely to receive indicated HART, even when they're in care. Now, if we fail to plan to deal with these disparities and the causes of these disparities, then we will have a much less impact on the epidemic than we might otherwise do. Now, I focused a lot on the U.S., but I want to say that in figuring out how to use PrEP around the world, there are a lot of country-specific factors. So we have racial and ethnic disparities, but any country will have priority groups that they need to identify as the groups to be included early in a PrEP program if you want to maximize the reduction in the epidemic. Every country will need to decide what types of providers and what sites would be appropriate for the provision of PrEP. They need to think about what the barriers are to rolling out PrEP and design their implementation strategies to overcome those barriers. In many places, we have lessons to learn from what has gone on with the scale-up of prevention of mother-to-child transmission and antiretroviral therapy programs. There are a variety of reproductive health and pregnancy issues that will also be important to consider as we think about PrEP for sexually active women. And there are, of course, within each country, funding and implementation partners that need to be identified and will be country-specific. At the CDC-funded trial sites, we've begun discussions with local partners about how implementation might work. You will note that on all these slides, there's a little umbrella. And that doesn't seem like an intuitive thing to do. I wanted to tell you a little bit, just one brief story about that. There's a story of a community that was suffering a serious drought. And the local elders gathered up all the villagers, and they took them to the home of the religious leader, who in the past had performed miracles. And they said to him, "Please, please, you must pray that we have rain." And he looked at the crowd and he said, "No, I will not pray. You have no faith." And they said, "Well, we do have faith. That's why we've come to you. That's why we're asking you to pray for us." And he said, "If you had faith, you would have come with umbrellas." And I think we need to think about implementation planning in a similar way as another kind of faith-based initiative. We need to have enough faith in the potential of PrEP to invest the time and energy in thinking about how we could use it effectively. This is not a presentation of one person, but a variety of people both within CDC and in the wider community. If you want additional information about some of these PrEP implementation issues, there are two good places to look. One is UCLA had a couple days of meeting about this, and the transcripts of those meetings are online at this site. And Dr. Lynn Paxton at CDC, who manages our trial portfolio, has recently published in The Lancet about some of the implementation questions that need to be addressed for PrEP. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We plan to have a discussion and questions at the end of the first session. But if there is any burning issues for clarity, that could be allowed. Otherwise, we'll move on. Okay? Thank you very much. The next speaker is Yasmin Halima, who's been around at the backbone of the Industry Liaison Forum for IAS. As I said at the beginning, she's representing Professor Salim Bauer, and she's going to give the presentation on that. Before she says, I just want to know that in spite of being a backbone of ILF, she's now a student and taking a master's program in Columbia University, New York, and the numbers she's being under the guidance of Professor Salim. Yes.
Thank you. Okay, every time I give a presentation, no matter what the subject, I always feel that I'm not qualified, that there should be someone else who's doing it who's much more qualified. Well, today I can honestly say that that sentiment is really true. So I want to start by expressing Professor Bloor's regret in not being able to be here, but at short notice he was unable to make it. I am not an expert in modelling, but I recently started an internship with Professor Bloor at UCLA. My interest is in understanding modelling techniques to assess the impact of PrEP on epidemiology, but also considering issues of equity and ethics. In particular, how can we define priority allocation criteria for PrEP should it be proven effective? So this is a presentation based on Professor Bloor's work that we jointly put together. But I want to start with a disclaimer. I will try and do and hope to do justice to her work, but I should stress that the expertise is all Sally's and the limitations are all mine. Okay, so with that disclaimer in place, my presentation has three objectives: to consider when and how models might be used, what kind of models can be used for what purpose, and finally, to illustrate some examples from the microbicide and the treatment world, drawing inferences for assessing the potential concerns and impact of PrEP. So why did we think a modelling talk at a PrEP implementation satellite would be useful? Well, the results of the first PrEP trials are due as early as next year, and together with formative research and policy analysis, modelling techniques can help determine what potential impact PrEP might have on a population of interest. More importantly, it can help inform policy decisions regarding distribution, allocation strategies, impact on local epidemics, and cost effectiveness. So when and how are models used? When we want to predict the unknown, different methods can provide different insight. Statistic risk equations are used to predict an individual's risk of daily of acquiring HIV. Dynamic systems of ordinary differential equations can be used to predict the temporal dynamics of incidence and prevalence. And operations research can be used to design drug allocation strategies. I just want to make a point about the importance of assumptions. When Sally was teaching me modeling, one of the things that she said is every time you're presented with a model, you should ask the question, what are the assumptions that have been made here and built into the model? A model is only as robust as the assumptions built into it. The more assumptions, the more complex and potentially less reliable the final outcome. The things that we don't know precisely, we build an uncertainty analysis. So what's an uncertainty analysis? It allows us to pick a reasonable range of values. These are then sampled n number of times and simulated in a model or risk equation. These techniques translate parameter estimation uncertainty into prediction estimation uncertainty. And what that means is that these analyses enable us to, one, predict the future with a degree of uncertainty, and two, to identify the key parameters that determine the future. So how can models be used in infectious diseases? The models have many uses. For example, models can be used to predict the epidemiological impact of interventions, to identify the most important variables that can drive an epidemic, and to design effective epidemic control strategies. here's an example of a prediction. These are based on 1,000 simulations. The treatment rate was varied, and the model used to calculate how many infections were averted. The blue data shows how many infections were prevented after 1 year of treatment, the yellow data after 5 years, and the red data after 10 years. I actually did have another slide which I took out, which is a very similar prediction in terms of the graph, but it shows the impact of treatment in an African setting, and so obviously the figures look very different because the background treatment rate is so different. What are the potential issues that we can model with PrEP? We can look at risk reduction. We can look at the evolution of drug resistance. We can look at PrEP and behavioral disinhibition. And we can look at PrEP and cost effectiveness. These issues are not new, and they've all been addressed in the context of treatment, microbicides, and post-exposure prophylaxis. Here's an example of the first, risk reduction. These are examples from published research. Sally's team, for example, have developed risk equations to calculate the risk of HIV infection for female sex workers by calculating the risk before the introduction of microbicides and the risk after the introduction of microbicides. And these are some of the factors that we can build in a risk equation. What you put in depends on the result that you're looking for. Here are some factors that can be addressed in a risk equation to give meaningful results. First of all, transmissibility for an individual in various sex acts. The number of each type of sex act per partnership. Number of partners, efficacy of protection used, whether that's condoms, microbicides, or PrEP. The proportion of each type of sex act in which protection is used, and the prevalence of HIV in a population. There are a lot of concerns about behavioral disinhibition. This slide shows the assumptions that were made in this particular model about behavior changes that could occur after microbicides are introduced. Condom users could either remain as condom users, so that's the first box, or become condom users plus microbicide users. Non-condom users could remain as non-condom users or as non-condom users but use microbicides. Different assumptions regarding behavior changes can also be included in the model. Models can be used to answer many different questions. Here are the three questions that we're addressing in this particular model. Can vaginal microbicides substantially reduce the risk of a female sex worker acquiring HIV infection? Which is more important to maximize, microbicide use or microbicide efficacy? What level of microbicide use and efficacy is needed to balance condom replacement? So in their model to the first question, they found, yes, vaginal microbicides can substantially reduce the risk of a female sex worker acquiring HIV infection. And the figures that they calculated were 17% risk reduction for a low efficacy microbicide and 30% with a high efficacy microbicide. To the second question, which is more important, use or efficacy? They found that microbicide use was most important. Intuitively, this makes sense. Even if an intervention is 100% safe, unless it's used, it cannot provide protection. Changes in microbicide use have more of an impact for a highly efficacious microbicide. For highly efficacious microbicide, they calculated this at greater than 50%. Poor adherence may not have as much impact and can still result in a high rate of risk reduction. However, for low efficacy microbicides, high use is needed to obtain even moderate levels of reduction. So there are always trade-offs. This slide is schematic showing the trade-off between microbicide use and efficacy and illustrates the answer to the question two. I haven't shown it here, but there's a nice example of this by Bloer et al. In Science, showing the impact of risk behavior following the introduction of an imperfect vaccine. Okay, so the question, could microbicides make things worse? The model here identifies the conditions where microbicides could make things worse, due to people replacing a very effective protection, i.e. a condom, with a lesser effective protection method, potentially a microbicide. The answer isn't simple and depends upon the initial condom usage, and microbicide efficacy. And what you see are the benefits, and actually that says perverse, but it means detrimental. We did have a discussion about what words to use. This is a picture up on Sally's wall. I should say her office wall and not at her home. of condoms migrating is a point that she makes about the semantics used in the field. And she stresses that what we're talking about is condom replacement rather than condom migration. Okay, so let's move on to some operational research type questions. So look at the issue of resource allocation. How can we equitably, ethically, and efficiently allocate PrEP, especially in countries with limited resources, to spend on prevention? So the problem posed here is that in a resource-limited setting, there are not enough drugs for everyone who needs them. So what can or should we do? Specifically, how should you allocate the limited supply of PrEP among healthcare facilities? Professor Blow, with her colleagues, has addressed this problem in the context of treatment allocation in a South African setting. This shows the location of the epidemic in healthcare facilities in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. And as we should see, the importance of spatial heterogeneity becomes a very important issue in resource-constrained locations. So the next few slides shows an analysis on the impact of different numbers of healthcare facilities and different catchment sizes on treatment equity. Using these results, the authors were able to calculate how much drugs should be given to each available clinic in the province in order to maximize treatment equity. So here's the equation. It shows the function of distance on access to treatment. So the slide shows treatment accessibility around each healthcare facility as a two-dimensional function that falls off steeply the further you go away from a healthcare facility. And this is area of province that will receive drugs if the catchment area is 20 kilometers. Okay, now see the same picture here. Same healthcare facilities, same population, and notice what happens to the circles if you expand the catchment region to 60 kilometers. So what I've just shown you is explained in a very elegant model in a PNAS paper. It illustrates one approach to calculating the optimal allocation of drugs between urban and rural areas in KwaZulu-Natal to maximize the impact of HIV. This is how I got interested in modeling. Professor Blower had a paper, this paper, and I had spoken to her during the Toronto conference when she was putting this together. And she mentioned to me that they had noticed that if you gave treatment to people in a Durban setting as opposed to a rural setting, you would get a differential rate of epidemiological efficiency. And her comment to me was, I don't know what you would make of the ethics of that, given that ethics was what I was studying at the time, and that's how we started our conversation and my study. The paper discussed the epidemiological impact of different allocation strategies that allocate drugs differentially between urban and rural areas. The authors found that to have the greatest impact on the epidemic, that is to maximize epidemiological efficiency, it would be best to give all of the drugs to the urban centers. This, of course, does not deal with the issue of treatment equity. Okay, so she makes a point about ethics versus equity, comparing two principles, ensuring that drugs are allocated so that everyone has equal access. And the other principle is epidemiological efficiency, ensuring that drugs are allocated so they have maximum impact on reducing the incidence rate. So thus, by comparing the two studies, they found that both goals, i.e. treatment equity and epidemiological efficiency, are both ethical, but it's not possible to achieve both. I want to finish with a couple of slides on calculating cost-utility ratios. Here's the post-exposure prophylaxis cost-utility ratio equation showing the cost of the PEP program, the number of HIV infections averted as a result of the use of PEP, HIV-related medical care costs saved per averted case of infection, the number of quality-adjusted life years saved per averted case of infection. And here's a graph that shows the results. So what is this? This is essentially a cost-benefit analysis to evaluate PEP if it was used in 96 metropolitan areas in the US. The y-axis is the cost-utility ratio expressed in net cost in dollars per quality saved. The lower the net cost per quality saved, the better the use of PEP would be in that area. So what's plotted here is the cost-utility ratio calculated for each of the 96 metropolitan areas that were analyzed. Therefore, the 96 bars in the histogram along the x-axis. So one of the main messages of this slide was that we can extrapolate that the cost benefits of PrEP will also vary considerably both within a country and between countries. So to conclude, modeling techniques have been applied to assess impact on epidemiology, individual risk, address issues of access to interventions and cost effectiveness of HIV interventions. Models can help assess the impact of PrEP in specific country and target group settings. Models can help inform policy development, particularly in areas where resources are limited. I want to finish by thanking Sally Blower and her team at UCLA for sharing their knowledge and their passion with me and their willingness and patience in teaching me the basics of modeling. I want to thank a special thanks to Dawn Smith and Lynn Paxton, who've been wonderful in helping me plan this program and put the meeting together. I want to thank Renee for her inspiration and support, and Rodney and Jacqueline, my colleagues at the IAS, for their support in my role at IAS. But most of all, I want to thank you for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And a quick question for clarity. Otherwise, we will move on and ask questions later. Before the discussion, the last speaker is Dr. Somonyot from the Minister of Health in Thailand.
Good morning. This is on my slide, I will talk about the lesson learned from Thailand, especially on AV grant spending that we have done it for many years, and also at the last part of my slide, I'll talk a little bit about the NGT program in Thailand. We saw the first phase of HIVS in Thailand about 20 years ago. Nowadays, the estimated number of people who have been infected with the virus will be around 1 million people. But the number of people still living with the virus is around 500 to 600,000 people still living with the virus. But anyway, the new HIV infection this year, from our estimation, is around 16,000 people. We know that even we try many things in from the past up until now, I think in some group we don't have an effective method in slowing down the pandemic. Especially on the slide, you see this is the HIV prevalence among general users. That when we try several things to lower the prevalence or even the incidence. Anywhere in some group, we can use condom. For example, among indirect sex worker, we started a 100% condom program distribution. The government pay for the condom, and we provided condom free of charge to female sex worker since around 1989 or 1990. And you see on the slide, after about 10 years, we can lower the HIV prevalence among the indirect sex worker and also in male clients who have sex with them and at the clinic. And also you see on the slide that this is the HIV prevalence among pregnant women, male conscript, and in or even in noted random seated. I want to remind you again that we started a prevention program, 100% condom program in 1989-1990 at the beginning of July. About 10 years later, then we can see the impact of the program. For the access to ARV treatment care, at the beginning we don't have the ARV drug, so we start treatment common opportunistic infection, for example, like tuberculosis, PCP, cryptococcal meningitis, and then we start using the monotherapy in 1992, and then we change to dual therapy in 1995, and until nowadays we use the triple regimen at the standard in the our main in our guideline. For Thailand National ART program, we initiated in the year 2000. And we can say that we can cover the whole area of Thailand in the year 2004 as promised by the government that we will allow everyone who are Thai people to get access to the treatment care. So the package that we provided for the Thai people, we have given three treatment 3 to 4 months, for example. And today, I think we are expanding to try to give condom free of charge to the people who are receiving treatment. And the guidelines say that you start AOV treatment at if the CD4 level is less than 200 cell per mil, or if the people have the symptomatic HIV, but the CD4 level is quite higher, maybe if less than 250, we will start the therapy. For the sports line regimen that we have used, we are using the 4T3 TC and Everpin. It's the drug that is manufactured by the government pharmaceutical organization. So this is the guideline that we use in the past. You see that we use the drug called Zipovir. Is one in one tablet. It contains three kind of drugs in the tablet, D4T, 3TC, and Nimodipine. The cost in the past is about $30 a month per one patient, but nowadays the cost is lower. In the year 2001, we started try to give the AV treatment to the people. I want to give some detail about the number of the hospital in Thailand that around 1,000 hospital is under the ministry. So most of the hospital in Thailand are under the ministry. So at that time, when we started the program, we invite the hospital to join the program. So at the beginning, just 109 hospital joined the program. At that time, we have limited budget, so we can provide a treatment for just only 3,000 people. I can remember the first, when I was in the district hospital at the beginning of the program, that we have quite limited quota for the people. So it's, I think a lot of people want to get into the program, but we cannot provide the drug for them. It's pretty at that time. But nowadays we have more budget and we can improve the program, and nowadays I can say that every district hospital in Thailand under the ministry can provide a treatment care using LV treatment for the people. And last year we have transferred the program to the National Health Insurance Office. So nowadays Thai people, everyone, if you have the problem and want to get a treatment care, can get it. So this is the number of the people are receiving the virus at every treatment program, every treatment in, under the program. On the blue line is the cumulative number of the people, and the pink line, the second line, you see the number who are receiving the drug under one program under the national insurance scheme. I want to tell you that the main health insurance scheme in Thailand, we have three, at least three. First one, national health insurance for everyone, for Thai people. And the second one, social security. If you are the worker, you are covered by the social security. And the third one, this is for the civil servant. They can get treatment if they are HIV positive and have the condition that are listed in our guidance. So if we want to know how many people are receiving the every treatment in Thailand, at the national health insurance, I think it's more than 80,000 people are receiving. And for the social security, more than 20,000. So if we add it up, I think it's more than 100,000 people are receiving every treatment right now in Thailand. We also got the money from the Global Fund. We try to integrate them and use the money to complement. For example, use the money from the Global Fund to buy drug or even to buy C4 machine, for example. And if the patient do not want to disclose their HIV status, they can pay and get the treatment from the private clinic or even the private hospital. In the past, we have the problem in distributing the drug to the hospital. We have the 12 regional health office around the country. So we have changed, reorganized distributing the drug to the hospital by using the something we call vendor managed inventory or VMI. So you make a contract with the government pharmaceutical organization. Now we are working through internet. Now we have to distribute the drug directly from the government pharmaceutical organization to the district hospital without being compared. In the past, we had to procure the drug and we had to distribute to regional staff and from regional staff to the district. Nowadays, we have changed our system to distribute the drug directly from the GPO, government pharmaceutical organization, to the hospital drug stock by using computer to update the stock. And this is the picture that shows the front page of the website of the GPO. You can look at it by visiting worldwideweb.gpo.org if you want to. So this is something that we've shown on the website. And not just only the drug mechanism, distribution mechanism that we have to address, we also have to address the company services, for example, like the C4 checkup. So we have to distribute the services, C4 checkup, the services to cover the whole country. So this is geographical distribution for centimeter or C4 machine that we have distributed to 76 provinces. I think nowadays we can cover 74 provinces, in which provinces which cannot have the 4 centimeter right now, they can send us a sample to nearby provinces. That's for the air treatment program, but for PMTCT, I think we have used the results from the study, for example, like the result from ATCT 076, that the cytobutin or ACT can decrease methotrexate transmission by 2/3. And then nowadays, I think we have used the guidelines on PMTC to cover the whole country. I think that could go quickly from that. We also use the result of the study we call PMTCT study in Thailand, for example, like SPT1, that if we start ACT at 28 weeks, we can decrease infection from around 30% to around 6%. And if we add nevirapine to existing regimen, we can decrease infection to around 2%. So we changed the regimen to new regimen in the year 2004, that the current regimen that we use, we have given ACT plus nevirapine and also meal substitution, only meal powder, free of charge to everyone. And we expected that we can decrease infection rate to about 30%. So this is the impact of the program. This is the number of pediatric cases from the year 1984 to the year 2003. That when we can cover the whole country in the year 2001, I think that you can see the impact program. We can lower quite a lot of number of infection in the infant. I think we have learned a lot from the two programs that we have to find the target population. We have to involve our stakeholder in the program, at the planning program, even in the doing and managing the program. So we try to, in both programs, we started as using the pilot project, and then we gradually scale up to cover the whole country. And also, we have to admit the fact that without a national guideline, we cannot accomplish that task. Now we really try to integrate the AV program in BMTCT to existing program. And finally, I think we have to thank Thai government that can, nowadays they can, they are the main source of the budget that we use in our program. That's all for my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Any quick questions, clarifications? Yes, please. Can you use the microphone? Sorry.
Good morning. I just would like to understand the concept of an indirect sex worker. I have never heard that.
Thank you. I think for the definition of direct or indirect sex worker, it is very complex to place. For example, like Thailand, direct sex workers mean that if the male sex worker are working in the brothel, usually we call them direct sex worker. But indirect sex worker, the people who are working outside, some place like that, for example, on the street, bar, nightclub, or call girl, perform, call them indirect sex worker.
Thank you for that. Now the session is open for discussion. Please use the microphone. Tell us who you are and your institution. Go ahead.
Hi, Ward Cates from Family Health International. Really a great start to an exciting conference in this area, and it's fun to see right from the beginning a focus on PrEP. I love Dawn's elements of planning that really take it from a positive spin right away, not in essence diverting of resources, but how do we add to resources, not disinhibition, but rather how do we design counseling. And I wonder if you've actually had experience, or any of us have had experience in other areas where this positive spin, especially in times where we're going to have difficult study results that might not show effectiveness, how that positive spin can maintain momentum. And then for Yasmin, it seemed to me that the model that's been done that is almost directly applicable to PrEP is the microbicide model that was published, because that it really focuses on use as the essential component for any of these prevention measures. And I don't know if that would be at least where you would start a model for an oral pre-exposure antiviral compared to the topical pre-exposure antiviral.
That was a question to the audience, I think. It was asking whether people had experience with other interventions with this sort of positive thinking framework. So I would invite people to come forward if they have examples to give to board.
Okay, Ford, can I then respond to your question about what can we learn from modeling of microbicides? We've had a lot of these discussions, and you can't take a particular model and apply it exactly as it is with the equations built in and the assumptions built in to PrEP for microbicides, given that one might be quota dependent, the other is taken daily, and the exposure rates might be different. And they might be available differently. One of the exciting things about PrEP is that actually if it works, we actually have a PrEP agent already available. It doesn't have to be developed, manufactured, and so on. And so the answer, I guess, is both yes and no. But it depends also what we're looking at. We could be looking at operational research issues, which is about distribution. Once we know that something works, how do we get it available to the people that need it? The other is, how do we use models to assess what the impact on epidemiology might be? How do we change the epidemiological landscape? So should we be giving it to those most risk of HIV? Should it be giving it to those people we can most easily access? And so those are different kinds of questions maybe that we want to extrapolate from what we've learned from microbicides, but not to apply it literally as it is. And I think that's also that one of the caveats. It's easy to do that, and we should do that.
I would add that there is actually already a model of PrEP implementation. For those of you who were at CROI this year, Ume Abbas from University of Pittsburgh, along with the Imperial College, has already developed a modeling exercise that's specifically tailored to looking at PrEP, and I think you'll see it in publications.
Okay, go ahead.
Tom Coates from UCLA. Thank you for a very, very interesting panel. Don, I'm delighted by the activities you're leading at the CDC and look forward to the unfolding of those activities over the next several years. And I think it's just very far-sighted that the CDC is planning this this kind of activity. You know, every time that I see the compelling data that are presented on African Americans in the United States, and particularly African American men who have sex with men, it seems to me that this is a really, really, really strong argument for ensuring that the efficacy trials that are going on among men who have sex with men enroll sufficient numbers of African American men who have sex with men in the United States. And I think it would do a couple of things for us. Number one, it might be an approach to reaching that population that we haven't tried yet. But number two, it will reach that population if it's done effectively. And I think enrollment in trials will be really quite crucial. Now, I know the studies in San Francisco and Atlanta are attempting to do that, but I would really like to see those scaled up or other sites scaled up for efficacy trials really focus specifically on that population. And I think that would be a very strong contribution to the entire field, both of research but also of a practical way to reach that population. The second point I would make, and now putting on a different hat, I sit on the board of the AIDS Project Los Angeles. And in fact, we have a planning meeting next Tuesday. And I think the dilemma faced by many AIDS service organizations, at least in the United States, and non-governmental organizations like AIDS Project Los Angeles, is that it does not have a clinical arm. It does not do clinical service. And so we're trying to figure out how to strategically position ourselves to prepare for pre-exposure prophylaxis and even thoughts about male circumcision. As you know, we serve a very large Latino population where male circumcision is relatively low. While we don't have data on efficacy in that population, it seems it's something we really need to think about. So I think we're trying to think of a variety of strategies to position that organization to be able to incorporate biomedical prevention into its full panoply. And it may mean strategic alliances with clinical providers like the LA Gay and Lesbian Center or the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. It may actually mean mergers. And I think that I would encourage you to think of that as part of your planning. The third point I would make, and this is a point that really came out in our forum at UCLA, is the issue that the very populations that are heavily burdened by HIV are those that have least access to care. I thought the modeling exercise, Yasmin, that you and Sally Blower did, and particularly looking at KwaZulu-Natal, and thinking that the greatest benefit would be in Durban, where there's closest access to health care. And I have a project in rural KwaZulu-Natal in Vulindlela, and I know the difficulties of having people access clinics because of the burden of distance and hills and weather and so on and so forth. And again, I think that's going to be a very long and protracted discussion. It applies both in the United States and elsewhere. How do we get this to those folks who need it the most? Thank you.
I want to say a couple things. Number one is I know that the trial in the U.S., which also includes a Boston site, has worked hard to recruit black MSMs into the safety study. And I think the approach that we're taking in terms of the surveys and the user research that we're doing is we're really focusing very much on African-American young people as the primary target for our planning. Not that we wouldn't provide it to other groups, but because of the access problems, the reimbursement problems, the many issues that affect that extremely high incidence population. Our feeling is that if we can come up with strategies for delivering PrEP services to that population, it will be easy to do it for the easier populations. But if we start with the easy populations, then we'll recreate this disparity situation where we don't get around to the other things. So I think outside of the trials, we're also trying to find ways to capture what the needs and the preferences are of those populations to incorporate into our planning early. In terms of the CBOs, I think I completely agree that we need to figure out in these strategies how to marry the different expertises that we have and not make this a hospital center or a clinic-based only intervention. So we've talked about things, for example, like whether you would come in initially to a medical center for screening or, you know, a clinic for screening and for prescription, but then when you have your periodic visits and your refill visits, could those be done, for example, in a pharmacy with a counseling room that includes counselors from the community-based organization and then the pharmacist is providing the refills? Could this be done in clinics that settings like, you know, Kmart has now putting medical clinics throughout the country. Kmart is a large department store chain. And again, could community-based organizations be partnered with nurse practitioners in those kind of settings? So I would encourage, again, everybody to start thinking creatively about how we can put these things together rather than creating competition.
Tom, I also wanted to kind of add a point to the issue that you raised about disparities in health and unequal access for some communities. I'm a member of the U.S. Activist Coalition, and we recently did a training in Louisiana, of all places, on several issues to do with HIV, and I was asked to give a talk on biomedical prevention technologies. So these, most of the people who turned up were very poor African-American or poor Latina, and most of them were already infected with HIV. So I really wasn't sure what kind of feedback I would get, given I was going to give a state-of-the-art talk about science and about PrEP and microbicides. And the level of interest was really remarkable. And the reason for that was, and we kind of engaged in discussion, was because they could relate their disadvantages in terms of their experience, and they were thinking about their children, and they spoke to me about their nephews and nieces and real examples of stigma in the community. In fact, it's not recently, for a long time, I haven't been to a meeting where people talk about HIV as their secret. And so that was really surprising for me. So if we're talking about strategies that communities can use that work for them, then I think, you know, PrEP could be a really powerful intervention, both for men and for women and for MSM use.
Yes, Mark?
As some of you know, our lab has been involved in studies on drug resistance that involve different subtypes. And from time to time, I get wind of someone saying that Mark Weinberg is opposed to PrEP because of considerations of drug resistance, and I just want to go on record that that is not true. I'm a very strong proponent of PrEP. I think all of us would agree that some level of drug resistance will be inevitable in regard to prevention strategies, perhaps no matter which one we employ. And we need to be vigilant and we need to understand this virus, but there's no doubt that PrEP is a major step forward and hopefully will provide meaningful results in preventing HIV disease before long, thanks to you on this podium. I do have a question in regard to modeling for Yasmin, who did a fantastic job, and I think Sally would be proud. But it really relates to something that I think we don't have a lot of information on, but is perhaps reflective of the fact that, as we know, certain viral subtypes seem to be responsible for a disproportionate number of new infections on a worldwide basis. And it does suggest the possibility that there is a lot about the biology of transmission of HIV disease that we really don't understand. And perhaps certain viral subtypes do have greater agility in regard to transmissibility than others. And I just wonder if it's possible to use the modeling equations and experience to take some of these differences into account. Is that a direction that some of the modelers might think of going?
Well, that's a great question. Sally says whenever I ask her something about can't this be modeled, and she says anything can be modeled. So I guess modeling gives us a lot of potential. One of the exciting things about modeling is that it can bring different kinds of people together. So Sally has one area of expertise. And when I was at her team, it was really interesting working with some of her postdocs. You know, you hear stochastic resonance a lot, but you don't hear K65R mutations or K103N. So they have different expertise that they bring. And so the potential for modeling to bring experts like yourself in drug resistance, people who understand pharmacokinetics, people who understand ethics and equity, people, you know, I think it's such a multidisciplinary, potentially it could be such a multidisciplinary approach that we could take. And a model is only as good as the information that you put in. So if people like yourself work with Sally and other modelers to build in those assumptions and define those as accurately as we possibly can in a given situation, and you can build in, and Sally's already done this in terms of drug resistance, but we could really put in nuanced information and make the models much more precise. But that really, as I said, relies on interface between different disciplines and different experts like yourself.
Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Hans Jäger from Munich, Germany. I have a clinical question. How would you manage an MSM individual who comes to a medical clinic these days on a Friday noon and he says he's going to Amsterdam for a large party there? And we know from experience that these parties have in 72 hours almost as many sex partners. How would you manage with the given information that we have now, and I know it's limited. It's a medical question, it's an ethical question, it's a lot of questions in one, but I would like to hear the panel on that question.
Well, I think right now we don't have information on the amount of efficacy of PrEP. So I don't think we can say that you should or should not provide PrEP. I think it is a decision that you have to make as a clinician based on your best understanding of the literature and the needs of your patients. But from a public health point of view, we don't yet have definitive proof that this is an effective approach. So I don't think that we could give you specific advice.
You know, Hans, we do have interesting doctors. We have a maverick doctor in London, for example, and when some of his patients go to him and they put a certain scenario, he does talk about, I mean, what he does officially, I don't know. But I remember reading in the LA Times maybe a year or two ago about doctors who do prescribe PrEP.
Now, if hypothetically it would work, and it may, well, does CDC have any plan for management of this situation? Do we have to test this man, or don't we have to test him? How do we counsel about possible resistance or non-resistance? We don't know if he's infected. Still, he comes and he asks for something. So if CDC is planning something, and I was glad to hear that, what would be the management situation once it works?
Well, first of all, CDC will eventually have recommendations when the trial data is in and after we've had appropriate consultations and come to consensus about it. But I think the important thing is that we're talking about PrEP programs now, both in the context of the trials and eventual implementation, that are more than just giving out pills to people. So we would always want to know somebody's HIV status before we would give them PrEP. So if someone comes in, you know, 5 minutes before their supposed encounter and you can't measure their HIV status, I don't think we would ever recommend that you give antiretrovirals to someone without knowing their HIV status and therefore knowing what's an appropriate regimen to put them on. And the second thing is, and I don't think we would ever recommend giving PrEP without giving some level of counseling about reducing risk behavior, about adherence, about a lot of things. And so I think that eventually we'll be talking about a whole package of things that goes together I would think of it more like we think about hypertension treatment or diabetic treatment. You know, you don't just give somebody an insulin kit and say, you know, go forth and manage your diabetes. There's a lot that goes with it that's built around that biomedical intervention. And I think in the case of PrEP, that's what we're planning or we're trying to develop.
Last one.
Couple of comments. First, Yasmin, please realize that you cannot believe everything that you read in the LA Times. That article that described off-label use of PrEP, was followed very closely by a study that was presented by Al Liu at the Toronto meeting, in which Al Liu of the San Francisco Department of Public Health did a very thorough series of surveys and inspections of circuit parties throughout the state of California, including Los Angeles and San Francisco, and he was unable to identify any substantial use of PrEP at this time. I think it's important to distinguish between post-exposure prophylaxis and pre-exposure prophylaxis. Post-exposure prophylaxis is recommended by the CDC. It is used in some urban centers, but as nearly as we can tell, PrEP is not used outside of a few boutique clinical practices in London and San Francisco, and even in those settings, it's very limited in its current use. But the more important point is, and I think that really serves to emphasize that the community has reasonable judgment in these affairs, that people are waiting for the results of trials. They want to know whether this is really going to prove to be safe and effective, and I think that there's a great deal more wisdom in our communities than sometimes we give them credit for. And following on that, I'd like to emphasize that even though PrEP sounds like a clinical or biomedical intervention, its use is really going to be very dependent on engagement with community-based organizations, and it's for the following reason. Unlike a vaccine, which might reasonably be offered to the general public, PrEP is only going to be cost-effective if it can be targeted successfully to high-risk individuals. And these are individuals who are HIV negative. They're not self-identifying as patients. They're self-identifying as members of the community. And I think it's going to be our community-based organizations. I think I'm being cut off. No. It's going to be our community-based organizations who will have the best information, the most sophisticated information about where these people can be found, how they can be identified, and how best to counsel them. There's a lot of talk and reasonable concern about the prospect of behavioral disinhibition, but remember the data. The data from post-exposure prophylaxis has shown time and time again that risk behavior actually improves in the context of post-exposure prophylaxis. There appears to be a synergy between a pill a day and the efficacy of counseling, but I think that synergy is won only if the PrEP or PEP is implemented in the setting of sophisticated counseling institutions. And these basically are our community-based organizations who are out there on the front line finding creative ways to promote condoms, creative ways to promote counseling and behavior changes, and it's going to fit very nicely into their repertoire to add a pill a day if it can be shown to be safe and effective.
Thank you very much. As we move on, I think this is the right time to move on to some roles which related to PrEP implementation. We have a panel discussion. We have Kate Hankins, who's now the Chief Scientific Advisor to UNAIDS, and she's coordinated the first UN plan, work plan on male circumcision and HIV, and co-chaired the UNAIDS WHO expert panel on ethical considerations in biomedical intervention. We also have, from the donor's perspective, Rene, who is a senior program officer in the HIV-TB program at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She's responsible for the overseeing of non-vaccine HIV prevention portfolio, including PrEP, male circumcision, and microbicide. We're supposed to have also Meko from Nigeria, but she's not here. And also we're supposed to have Wim Paris from Tibotec, is unable to be with us, but we are very lucky to have Dan Blume, who is the Vice President, Group of Virology, Communication and Public Affairs from Tibote. Dan is not new to this field. He was once a Chief of Staff at DNA's before he joined Tibote. So for this, in order to give my co-chair Yasin an opportunity, she's going to lead the questions and answers. So I hand over to
Yes. Thank you very much. So before we kind of take questions, this was meant to be just an interactive session to have experts up here for you to be able to put questions to them. But I wanted to start the session by asking each of the panelists just to take 2 minutes to consider from their agency perspective what are the critical issues and the contribution of their agency in PrEP implementation if it should be proven effective. Could we start with Renee?
Thank you, Yasmin. I wanted to start off by saying that the Gates Foundation is exceedingly interested in support of trials looking at pre-exposure prophylaxis. This is a very promising intervention and something that we think is important to get a final answer on as to whether or not it's efficacious. The foundation supported the trial in West Africa that showed that it was safe, and is considering some additional funding for ongoing trials and planned trials of PrEP. The implementation question is a very important one, and something that a new foundation, such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, hasn't dealt with to date. And is something that we've been thinking about quite a bit, more sort of acutely with regard to male circumcision, now that the trial results for male circumcision are available and show it to be a highly efficacious intervention. And so we've realized that the answer does not end at providing a relative risk and a p-value from a trial, but must be extended beyond that. Beyond that, in order to think of proper ways for catalyzing implementation, uptake, and adoption of these methods. The question of actually when you start to do this is a very hard one. It's like, in my experience as a physician, when do you replace an aortic valve? That's insufficient. If you do it too early, you've caused your patient some morbidity. If you do it too late, you've caused your patient some morbidity, and you have to read your crystal ball and decide exactly when's the right time to do it. And there's not a lot of indication as to exactly when that's going to be. And so we want to make sure we use efficient use of resource and time, and put resources toward implementation when there's a good idea that we're going to be implementing something. So we're going to learn some lessons from male circumcision that we are getting started with now. Hopefully we have a strategy in place, and we're going to be thinking about funding some male circumcision projects. And that will inform us about future interventions, which we realize need to be implemented and will probably need foundation support to implement. Now, that said, the Gates Foundation does not view itself as either the circumciser of all the men in the world nor the provider of all PrEP in the world. So it's something that needs to be coordinated with multiple partners, ministries of health, international organizations.
Yes, I guess the question would be for the normative agencies. First of all, do you know what a normative agency is? I didn't until I joined one, and discovered that normative agencies such as UNAIDS and WHO require, first of all, that trials be completed in order to be able to come out with recommendations on what should be done with the information. And in that process of coming to consensus, as Don was speaking about at CDC, it's a question of validating the findings and then trying to look at what the situations to which they are applicable, the populations that they might be applicable to, and coming out with recommendations with respect to whether this is going to be applicable in a generalized epidemic, in a concentrated epidemic, etc. Our experience in the last couple of years with male circumcision has prepared us, I think, somewhat for moving ahead with PrEP. Obviously, there are a number of different trials of biomedical HIV prevention products going on in the field. And one of the things we think is absolutely critical is that those that are going on now continue to their completion, that they have, they're not only scientifically rigorous, but they have good community engagement and involvement. We have come up with some guidelines for that called Good Participatory Practice Guidelines for Biomedical HIV Prevention Trials. And we've also updated the ethical considerations document from 2000, from the year 2000, that's used mainly for vaccines. And it's updated now for all HIV biomedical prevention trials. So these are the, this is the kind of role that a normative agency would play in the initial instances of making sure the trials continue and that when results come in, that there is an internationally recognized validation of the findings and recommendations for countries on how to move forward. Once those are out, then our role moves into a technical support kind of role where we're looking at supporting countries to hold stakeholder consultations where they decide what the acceptability is, where this would sit for the population. Situational assessments. So this is the kind of thing where you would look at service availability, mapping, where would this best be provided, by which providers and to whom, setting up an operations research framework so that as implementation moves forward, there is iterative learning and improvement of programs, and trying to identify perhaps some lead countries that move forward with something like PrEP. They might be three or four countries that decide to move forward. We'd give more intensive support to them and have them come together meeting regularly to share their experiences and become, in a sense, the peer opinion leaders, but at a country level, for the implementation of a new modality like PrEP. I'll stop there.
Thanks, Yasmin, and good morning, everyone. As representing Tubotec, I suppose we can't speak on behalf of the industry as a whole, but there might be some observations that might be quite useful to taking this debate forward. Tubotec has had a long interest in preventative technologies. We made available the first compound on a royalty-free basis to IPM, the International Partnership for Microbicides. That's a non-nucleoside analog called TMC-120, and it's now being looked at in the ring and as the gel. We indeed have an interest in PrEP and have a compound in a very early development. It's a formulation of one of our other non-nucleoside analogues, TMC-278. Slightly more broadly, we have an interest in R&D for the global AIDS response, whether it be new compounds for TB, whether it be treatments for oral candidiasis, and of course access to our broader antiretroviral portfolio. And in fact, the parent company of Tubotec, Johnson & Johnson, provided the diaphragms for the recent UCSF Gates study looking at diaphragms in prevention. So why would a company like Tubotec be interested in PrEP? I think it's both a responsibility and an opportunity, but I think to be clear, this will not be a business as usual model. It's not enough to expect the development of a compound for industrialized world markets and then somehow expect that to be rolled out or handed over to global efforts. I think we have to look at a model of bringing R&D much earlier on into the access agenda. Certainly there will be compounds, and there's research going on at the moment in existing compounds, but we're going to have to be looking at this longer term. And finally, I'd just want to add that I think in terms of opportunities and concerns for PrEP, I think somewhat as Robert Grant observed, there really does need to be an emphasis in incorporating PrEP into the broader prevention efforts. It's something that Kate and I have worked on for many years at UNAIDS and in previous places, but this would not could not replace existing comprehensive prevention efforts. Rather, it might be a tool to help us maximize the utility of those.
Okay, so I'd like to encourage you to come to the microphone with questions for all these lovely people here. But while you do that, I want to start with a couple of questions. One to our industry representative and one to Kate. So, Ben, given that there may not be a strong commercial incentive for a PrEP agent, given where it is that we want to use it, could you describe what might be the incentives and, importantly, the disincentives for industry to get involved in PrEP research and implementation? And my question to Kate would be, I'm intrigued at the concept of lead countries. And at the meetings that I've been in on PrEP research, we've talked about country preparedness for PrEP research. Could you say a little bit more about what your criteria for country preparedness for a PrEP delivery program might be? Could we start with Ben?
Okay. I referred to the need for a different business model here. I have to say I'm going a bit beyond perhaps some other colleagues would do, but I think that current business model for developing compounds for the industrialized world is actually probably coming to the end of its time. I think we're going to have to be looking at models of contributing to global health in innovative ways, and I think that's going to be through low-price, high-volume models. I think it's going to involve collaborations with funders like the Global Fund, like procurement agencies like UNITAID. Once we have compounds that have come through the full regulatory process, and I think increasingly companies like ours, if one is going to play in the global health arena, has to recognise the role that meeting the needs of all people at risk or living with HIV, face.
I think this is a very interesting question. Thanks, Yasmin. The country preparedness is probably going to depend on a number of different things, but what happened with male circumcision was because we had one trial reporting and it was agreed and understood that we would not come out with recommendations based on the results of one trial, it meant there was lead time to work on country preparedness while we were waiting and anticipating the results of other trials. And I think we'd have to look at the timeline to see how much Don is talking about when the first one's going to report, to see how much lead time there's going to be, or are they going to come so quickly and in such an avalanche that there will not be that kind of preparation time. I would think in terms of potential lead countries, and I'm just inventing this on the spot in a sense, one of the things that could be looked at would be, and I would be very interested to hear what Ellie has to say about this, to take a country such as Uganda that's already instituted in at least two districts now and beginning to roll out to other districts, community-based home HIV testing, where we meet that criteria that Don wanted, where we know the HIV status of the person, and where counseling can be associated, and where 60% of the households that have an HIV-positive person in them are discordant couples, that this would be a prime population in which to try to move the initial integration of PrEP into a developing country setting. Now, that's just one example I can think of where we might do almost I call it a pilot program, not a pilot project, but a pilot program to see how that rolls out. And obviously, because that's district-focused, then you could hold the kinds of community consultations to find out about the acceptability of this and understanding about it, etc. I mean, those would be the kinds of things that...
Yeah, of course, Uganda will always be very interested in the outcomes of this study. And bearing in mind the magnitude of our problem. Yes, as Kate has said, we are moving to getting the communities involved and accepting testing as a way or a preventive measure line. Definitely approaches to implementations already underway. As you may know, the circumcision studies have been done in part of our world and already people are talking about those issues. So the situation It's probably slightly different compared to other countries. One other thing which I had wanted to make a comment earlier on, when someone from the audience talked about specific targets of vulnerable populations, which might be cost-effective. In some countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, it is no longer easy to identify communities which are vulnerable. The reason is that with the high seroprevalence prevalence and the presence of HIV, what is the high risk is basically being sexually active. Many people, and I will quote, for example, in South Africa, where rape is rampant, you may be a nun, and then on your way to the church, you could be raped, suddenly become a risk group, although you were not initially classified that way. So it is actually, the issue is mainly being sexually active, and I think PrEP here has to be seen in that way as we try to implement the findings.
So, Renee, if I could ask you, you mentioned about the limited role of a donor agency in terms of actual infrastructure, capacity building, and delivery of interventions that work. I wonder, therefore, if you could comment a little bit about how you see the future of PrEP research.
Well, firstly, I do want to say, just with regard to microbicides, the Gates Foundation has put well over, at this point, probably in the range of $200 million into microbicides and plants and more. That's not quite a limited role, but it's but again, it's not going to be providing the microbicides, manufacture of microbicides for the world supply if a candidate is found to be effective. But and I also actually also want to emphasize the need, and Dawn talked about this, but the need, once implementation starts, for very good monitoring and evaluation, because there are going to be very important lessons that need to be learned. And so we need to be wary of that and make sure that we have the mechanisms in place to best be informed of what we are working on that does work better and what doesn't work so well. And so then you asked me about future PrEP research. There was a very good meeting that was held by NIH, and Ward Cates put it together in January of this year, and I really enjoyed it. I attended this meeting, and this brought the important many of the important research stakeholders with regard to PrEP into a room and talked about where we need to go with PrEP research. And it was a very good exercise for some fairly good consensus building about where PrEP research needs to go. And the following few important points came out of that meeting. Firstly, that the ongoing trials do not have the ability to rule out less than 30% effectiveness because of the size and the power of the trials, and that as future trials go forward, they should be able to determine whether or not the intervention is 30% or more effective, because cost effectiveness modeling has shown that for this to be effective on public health intervention, from a public health intervention point of view, that effectiveness needs to be in place. And so there was a call to make the trials have enough power to actually answer those types of questions. Also, there was realization that the current trials are, when the results are put together, there's going to be an overrepresentation of men in those trials, and therefore more information is needing to be available for women. And also, it recognized discordant couples as being a risk group for HIV infection as Ellie's pointed out, in areas where the epidemic is well established, and that there needs to be interventions for discordant couples, especially since condoms cannot be used in the case of discordant couples who are looking to conceive, so that PrEP might be a very ideal intervention for established discordant couples. All HIV infection happens in discordant couples by but by discordant couple, I mean established long-term discordant couples. And so the field has responded nicely in designing trials that are sort of arranged or are looking at those needs and are designed around those needs. So there is a and the other element that was discussed was the need for an intervention to look at MSMs more closely, because the only trial that was ongoing to date is a safety trial in MSM and would not have the ability to talk about efficacy. And I think that there has been a move to try to for the trials to meet those parameters with power and to include the groups that were highlighted as highest risk.
Yes. Tell us who you are, your institution.
Yes, my name is Kristen Duarte from the University of Nairobi. My question, maybe to Kate. The largest number of people in discordant relationships are discordant couples. In our work in PMTCT, we know that women do not disclose their HIV status to their partners. Even in clinical trial settings, less than 15% will disclose to their partners. Is there any work going alongside these PrEP studies to look at models of disclosure or informing people that they're exposed to HIV so that they can find out whether they are in a discordant relationship so that they could benefit from PrEP? My second question is, the other group of people who are exposed are babies of HIV-infected women. These new products being looked at in the context of PrEP, is there any work to look at them in the context of breastfeeding infants?
Maybe Dawn could answer that question, that second question. Even the first one, if you want.
There is a trial ongoing now, a safety study looking at, I believe there's a zidovudine alone arm, a TDF and zidovudine arm, and a Truvada and zidovudine arm, looking at dosing and safety for prevention of perinatal transmission. That is being looked at. In terms of discordant couples, I'm not aware of any work that's done in association with PrEP that's looking specifically around disclosure issues. I think in the trials, we certainly ask questions about whether people tell their partners they're in the trials, but I don't think we've looked specifically at what she's asking about.
But I can address the trial, but I also want to just follow up, because I've become an advocate on a certain point, and it's about the perinatal transmission. It's important to take a look at drugs that are going to prevent transmission to breastfeeding babies from infected moms. But, of course, we all need to bear in mind that the most effective way of preventing perinatal transmission is to provide good contraception to HIV-infected women who do not want to be pregnant in the first place. As far as the trials that are ongoing, and perhaps Lute and Ward can also address this, in the microbicide trials, there has been discussion as to whether or not there should be partner testing and in what places partner testing taking place. And I think in the trials, certainly where there's a seroconverter, partner testing is offered because, you know, probably you're going to find another positive person. If the person who's converted has a regular partner, but there's been talk about whether or not partner testing should be offered to just the participants who are uninfected, and I don't know what the status of that is with regard to happening, if that's been resolved or how that's happening in trials. And I don't do you have any information on that? Do you want to know? So I think it's not happening, but it certainly is something that has been discussed as well. And Lynn will comment on that, I think.
Paxton from CDC. I just wanted to make a comment that in our, for example, in our Botswana trial, we actually encourage all of our participants to, to bring in their partners for testing, so it is offered to them. So it's not mandatory.
Not just the seroconverters, but all.
Not just the seroconverters. It's a service we make available to everyone.
What about the people that screen out negative?
For those, we don't Well, once they screen out negative, you know, they're really just no longer part of the study. But we always encourage people to, you know, to know there's DAS in their own. But it's not actually formally offered to their partners.
Same for the microbicide trials in cellulose sulfate. We offer that women could bring in their partners, but we work with multi-partner women. So that's a totally different aspect to partner testing.
And I would just say the experience from the home-based testing program is quite interesting because it is conducted under the conditions of the three C's, meaning that there's confidentiality, counseling, and consent. People decide when the people are in their home whether they want to receive the results together or receive them separately. The testing is done right then and there once you agree. And we know from around the world that when couples get their results together, there's less domestic violence. There's more understanding of the situation. There's more support in the situation. So I think all of our efforts to try to reach out to get partners to come in, I mean, they're laudable, but they're not anywhere near as successful as when we actually reach out to people in their own homes and ask them about HIV testing and they counsel and test together.
I do want to add, though, with regard to one trial that is ongoing, and that is a trial that is where Connie Kellum is the principal investigator, and it's a trial that is being done to look at suppression. It's in discordant couples, and the HIV-infected partner who also has HSV infection is given suppression of HSV in order to decrease infectiousness of HIV based on data that has shown that HSV and HIV have a copathogenesis. Anyway, in that trial, there needs to be couples counseling and testing because discordant couples are recruited into the trial. And one of the legacies of that trial will be establishment of couples counseling and testing programs in the sites where the trial is ongoing. And it's not, it isn't a no-brainer in that if you know how to counsel an individual, you know how to counsel a couple. There's additional training and expertise and things that need to be in place for couples counseling. But a move toward increased numbers of couples counseling or amount of couples counseling that'll done is also probably important, and it is well accepted in the context of the trial that where it's being used currently.
Kate McQueen is going to kill me, but... as part of the Gates-funded West Africa trial, there actually was a series of protocol-driven formative data collected, part of which was planned to find out what was going to be the best approach to implementing that type of intervention, if successful. And for a whole variety of reasons, the trial didn't provide an answer to the if successful part, although as you pointed out, it was safety. Kate, I don't know if you want to describe at all the plans for how you were going to be gathering data in order to guide the implementation in those countries where the trial had occurred.
Yeah, it was obviously an aspirational goal at that time. And basically, we wanted to be able to interview participants to find out their experiences in the trial, what could be done to help encourage use, what were the factors that encouraged compliance or became barriers to compliance and what that would mean for rolling out a program. We plan to interview all of the clinical staff working on the trial to find out what they were seeing as the barriers and facilitators. We plan discussions with providers in the community, NGOs, others who were providing services and care, which we also had interviewed quite a number of them before the trial even began as well. We wanted to basically look at a range of issues, collect a variety of data that would help us to understand how we might do a translation to a program, what needed to be in place, what the recommendations were going to be locally for making it happen in a constructive manner. We ended up actually doing that kind of follow-up activities after the trial in each of the three countries where we conducted the research, but it took a bit of a different focus. We ended up actually looking more at what was the experience with the trial, especially in those places where controversy arose, and the implications for conducting research in the future rather than focusing so much on what the outcome, how the outcomes might be applicable to the possibility of an actual program. So, and we, at this point, as we're looking at the possibility of research, Truvada in Africa, we are basically looking at a similar model. Also, I know that in with Lute's CS study, there are also some opportunities to, again, look at issues around, well, what would be the possibilities following a trial, how you follow up with information to the communities, and making sure that ultimately the outcome becomes a positive one and that we have lessons learned that can be applied whether to a particular trial outcome or to the development program later, how we can begin to consolidate that information. I guess the last thing I'd want to say related to that is one of the struggles I think we all face is that there's a lot of experience that we're all gaining from implementing these trials, whether it is how to work with disordered couples and improve our ability to improve communication between the couples to bring more people in for testing and reduce the stigma associated with infection status. One of the things we struggle with is getting all of that information to a place and in a form where we can all learn from it. It often becomes trial-specific lessons learned, and it requires actually a fair amount of energy and resources to bring a group of people together and come up with a way to consolidate that knowledge. And so one of the things that I think is really important is that we have more opportunities to do that in a targeted, focused way so that that information and that learning from experience doesn't disappear. It's not often written up. It's not often put in any form that we can use in subsequent trials. And over the course of 5 years, 10 years, that knowledge gets lost. So just a plea for finding a way to build that knowledge.
Yeah, Bob Bailey from University of Illinois, Chicago. Several people have said I think we can learn a lot of lessons from circumcision. And one of the things that we did learn is that there's a certain amount of evidence that has to amass before the international public health community is willing to start even thinking about a particular intervention. So I would just put in a plea in the case of PrEP that the normative agencies and others try to decide now what level of evidence are you going to need before you actually endorse PrEP, and what kinds of evidence from what populations, is one trial going to be enough? Are you going to need several trials? One of the things from the modeling I think that comes out is that the models are sensitive to cost of the intervention, relative risk of the intervention, and then the HIV prevalence. So in some, as our colleague from Uganda suggested, in some populations where prevalence is high, PrEP may be appropriate for a broad spectrum of people in the population. So what's going to happen when there's a generalized epidemic? Is PrEP going to be advised for everyone, and is it going to have to be clinic-based in that case? I haven't heard much discussion about sort of expectations for Africa, for example. And then one other thing is, we had a trial on circumcision, and there was a lot of lead time. So we had one trial that showed efficacy. Now we've had three trials that have shown efficacy. We're 7 months after the time when all three trials have shown efficacy, and still circumcision interventions have not started. So we'd like not to be in that kind of situation with PrEP. So it's great that this panel is meeting, but there's still a lot of work to be done, and I would just encourage everyone to keep working at it so that when and if an effective, efficacious treatment comes along, we're in better position than we were with circumcision.
I guess representing the normative agencies, I should reply to Bob. I think one of the things about the role of the normative agencies as sort of the international public health representatives or whatever, we act as kind of a gatekeeper, not so much on domestic resources. I mean, a country could decide to go ahead. They'd prefer to wait until World Health Organization, UNAIDS, come out with recommendations. But certainly a gatekeeper on international funding through Global Fund, through PEPFAR, through World Bank MAP. And if the example of male circumcision is you know, to be followed or similar or whatever, none of those agencies will move unless a country has decided and made an explicit request for funding in order to be able to implement. Now, I think male circumcision is a little different, Bob, from PrEP in the sense that there are so many cultural overlays in terms of the way in which people think about it and their willingness to move on it. And sometimes this is not reflective of what the population thinks. There are some higher order gatekeepers that take some time to convince about things. But I think, you know, with PrEP, the question would be that you asked how many trials, which populations, and so on and so forth. I think that's something that we have to see. It is, you know, in a sense, like a regulatory thing where FDA and other regulatory agencies will not move on the results for one phase three trial in general. So there has to be more than one trial. There has to be some confirmation and validation from other trials before there would be a recommendation made. But at this point, I can't say how many trials and which populations are going to move and what. But I see Dawn's getting up to the microphone, so she can maybe speak to perhaps some discussions that have occurred in the U.S.
I would say a couple things. First of all, for the U.S., CDC is the normative agency, and so that's why we have started to engage in planning for the U.S. and not addressed issues about Africa and other things yet. In terms of the number of trials, it's interesting. If you look at the other example, at the other poll, is prevention of mother-to-child transmission. That was a single trial. And the trial stopped early. And within 3 months, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, CDC, and the whole public health system in the U.S. had issued guidelines for how to use it. The reason that that happened that way was that a lot of thought and planning had gone in before the trial result came out, anticipating that it might, in fact, work. So I think there's a range of things. Sometimes if it's a new mechanism, if it's a vaccine, for example, it is going to require more than one trial. There's no doubt about it. Okay, it may be one large efficacy trial, but it's probably going to be multiple sites and, you know, cover lots of populations, and, you know, you're going to have a broad look at it. But it's not always the case that we need multiple trials before we decide to act. And so I think the important issue is that we do need to specify in advance. We do need to start having conversations. You know, and it may depend on the result of that first trial. Let's say that the first trial shows 90% efficacy. It's going to be treated very differently than if it shows 40% efficacy. So I think it's the process of discussing it and coming to some preset conclusions is really important.
We're running behind time. So Tom, can you be quick, and then the next one, brief as possible.
I'll be extremely quick. I'll speak as a social scientist, and usually we speak for a long time, but I won't. It's really quite an interesting observation that the brilliance of the International AIDS Conference in Durban was the world standing up and saying it's really unconscionable that where you live determines whether or not you have access to ARVs. And people have talked about, for example, male circumcision from a human rights perspective, but it seems to me it's quite surprising, and this may happen with PrEP, and it certainly should be happening with prevention of mother-to-child transmission. It's quite surprising to me that the world isn't standing up and saying, we should have access to this as a fundamental human right. This is a life-saving, life-extending technique. And why is it that we don't have that level of people yelling in the streets saying, this is just patently unfair, that this is not accessible now? So I think one of the best things that we could probably do in order to generate that kind of activity, and I come from an era, I was in Berkeley in 1968 rioting in the streets, is to perhaps figure out ways of building civil society that would activate and energize countries to not do business as usual. And I find this an extremely frustrating event that we have these conversations when, in fact, one would hope that the countries would demand this as a right to save their populations. Thank you.
Peter Cherutich from the Ministry of Health in Kenya. I just want to echo Bob's comments here that with circumcision, yes, there's been a lot of time lag between the time the results came out and the time that we're starting to see the implementation. I believe we have an opportunity to do different with this. And I guess a lot of guidance definitely from WHO looking at already, you know, sensitizing governments to be able to have some basic information to start beginning the process for engaging what we call the gatekeepers. And I can assure you that there's a lot of gatekeeping that will be seen with PrEP, probably more than circumcision. So, and we need to start that process even when we don't know where the results is going to go. So we'd have the two scenarios of if the trials will show some evidence, if not, the trials will not. So what we do need to do and what level of engagement we require. And I think that process should start now.
Thank you very much. I would like to take this opportunity to thank all the panelists and all those who have contributed from the audience, and also all of you who have dared to come this early on a Sunday to be with us.